He's looking for entrepreneurs. He's creating businesses. So that's a great example of where the old style was, let's give farmers seed, fertilizer, and go home in 3 years or whatever it is. And that is never going to change things at scale. So what Joe's doing is a great example of how you create businesses and how the market works to help people become seed dealers. And when you're seed dealers, then you know you have a different motivation. And some of the things that undermined our efforts today are the fact that when you give things to people, they don't value them. And so now you have to get people to understand that better seed has a value, that even though the government has to play the strongest role in it, knowledge has value. So, you know, those are things that you have to get across. And you're fighting. I mean, we had a great project in Liberia, and it ultimately failed because when we made people pay for things, but would assist with capital and all that, but, you know, when they had to pay for things, they would go, well, but I can go down the road and get it for free. And you're dead in the water because you can't, I mean, how can you compete with free? But you don't create value. The very flip side of that, to give you a completely, the other side of it, is the World Food Program. We've pioneered a program in Central America that comes under their kind of umbrella of P for fee, purchase for progress. And that is where we've tried to take farmers and put all the elements in place that allow them to enter the market. So the goal, some people have misunderstood that program, because the goal ultimately is not that they sell the World Food Program. What World Food Program does is it's really a crutch. It gives them a guaranteed sale. It's not worked perfectly everywhere. There are some bad stories, but there are mostly good stories. And, you know, when you're working in difficult environments, nothing's going to be perfect. But ultimately, it's the concept of getting farmers so that they are free to make choices, they're independent, they increase their income, and they can ultimately choose who they want to sell to. But it's a big job getting somebody who has never had the access to the capital, never had training in the decision-making, and never even understood a contract because they never entered into a contract. But those are all the things you have to overcome. But you overcome them, you put these farmers into market, their whole life is different. So I think there are innovative ideas, and I think there's a lot of people doing that. There'd be a lot of people doing things I don't even know about. But I do believe that is the mindset that has to prevail.
You mentioned the importance of the U.S. economy to the global economy. If you could expand on the remarks that you made upstairs.
it's just a very obvious thing. I mean, obviously, the U.S. economy is so central to not just to the economic system of the world, but to the confidence people have that what has been a very fragile recovery is maintained. The U.S. economy is so dominant, so essential that for the outside world, we hope not simply that it is sorted out now, but that you get to a more stable and predictable situation. Now, how you do that's a matter for Americans, but for those of us from the outside, we just want to see the country strong and working well.
Laura Rance from Canada. Much of the emphasis at this event and most of the discussion is about increasing production and increasing productivity, and yet 30% of what is produced today is lost. Why isn't that issue getting more attention, or what do you do to get more attention to that particular issue?
Well, there's two. I mean, I look at that question in a country like the United States differently than I look at it in developing countries, obviously. So the one in developing countries, and I'm glad to answer both, but that's more what we're here talking about, is that, you know, it's, I hate this term, but it's the lowest hanging fruit. I mean, it's like, you know, I mean, you've produced it, now keep it. But that's a great example of where when you go into the field and you see what the challenges are. You know, it's easy for us to sit in the Midwest in a temperate climate and build storage systems because we have electricity and power and all the things that we need, plus the climate. you get into a tropical environment where you don't have power. And I mean, you know, so again, it really does go back to, I think most people in agriculture understand how critical that is, but it's probably one of the most difficult things to fix. I mean, when I was in Cuba this summer, and, you know, that was one of the biggest issues these farmers talked about, was we can't store what we keep. And they had all these questions about, you know, what can we use? And the funny thing is they had in their head some things that, you know, we use in this country. And I said, well, I would back up and look at how we did it in 1950. And I would look at a lower tech. And that's not an insult to anybody. That's just saying, look, you don't have the power systems here. You don't have the import systems that allow you to bring in what you want. So, you know, whatever, every country's up against a different thing. But, you know, so take what you can and make it work. When you have disease and bugs and climate that will not let you just store maize, the things that fix that are not really clever ideas. They are infrastructure. They are the ability to pay as a farmer to use that infrastructure. So I think even though it's the easiest place to attack hunger, it's the most difficult one, or it's one of the most difficult ones to solve.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I think for us in the work that we do, one of the reasons we often focus on infrastructure is precisely because it's essential to dealing with the problem of the food that goes to waste. So to give you some very specific examples, if you're talking about countries, say, in the west coast of Africa, and you know, they don't have proper roads to get the food to market, and they don't have the ability to store and refrigerate, then, you know, a lot of it is going to be wasted. And then, by the way, if they get the feeder roads built, but the roads are not tarmac properly, then come the rainy season, often those roads will be unusable. So, you know, this is where these issues to do with agricultural production meet the absolutely fundamentally the questions has the government got the wherewithal to deliver the basic infrastructure for the country? And if they do that, then everything can move.
There's not always a good answer to everything, to be honest with you. I mean, I was in Sierra Leone a number of years ago. We got stuck six or seven times getting up to the village we were going to because the roads were so bad. And these guys had piles of lettuce that they had produced. And they're all just sitting there completely depressed, thinking, I can't sell this, I can't move it, I can't get it transported. There's not a single thing I can do about that. So I think, you know, you have to be, again, realistic about what the solutions are. And until they are able to invest in that infrastructure and give people opportunities to have access to markets, there's really not a good answer for that village. Well, I think that the answer is that it's not, you can't pull the piece out like that. I mean, the truth is the people who have the biggest challenges with that storage are the people who are going to get the opportunity to produce more at the end of the trail, to be honest with you. So I think, you know, it all goes hand in hand. I mean, as you hope that you can increase productivity, then, you know, you hope that you can bring some of these other things that come with it, because some of them are really hand in hand. I mean, you're going to have a hard time if you can't get good seed out to somebody, then you're not going to increase their productivity. I mean, some things are pretty basic. So I think they kind of trail each other.
Hi, I'm Larry Dreiling. I'm with High Plains Journal in the United States. I want to talk to both of you about how this partnership unfolded for both of you, and describe it, the financial partnership, a little bit, in terms of these fellowships, I guess you might call them, that you're going to be announcing at next year's World Food Prize event.
Well, the partnership for the fellows is that we obviously help with the government side of this, because these are people who are going to have these ideas, and then they're going to go out actually in country and implement those ideas, and we will give them both money to do that and then money also to be able to live there and so on. So you need to fix the the host country side of it, which is what we will really look after, and then the partnership with Howard's Foundation, the World Food Prize, will be to try and organize the competition in the right way and get the right entries and then judge it properly.
How many do you
want to try to start with? So we'll start with four, and each of these will be given $150,000 each as a result of having won the prize to go and implement their idea.
And it's open globally. And actually, the World Food Prize is going to put the panel together to make the selection, so we'll have no involvement in that. But I think, you know, it goes to your question earlier. I mean, how do you get innovation? How do you get change? How do you get – so, you know, what I have learned is the younger generation, which is a lot younger today than I like to admit, they think differently. They have different tools at their in their hands. It's really pretty amazing what can happen with technology. And, you know, I don't believe technology can solve every problem by any means, but where it can solve problems, it ought to be used. And so this is really an effort to try to get some of the best minds, of young minds, to think about what are some of the solutions and then give them the financial opportunity and the access to an organization that can provide it to go try to do something. If this works, believe me, it'll be something that we do more of.
Right. And just as I was on the way out of the meeting, actually, there was a young guy who gave me an idea already, so I think the thing's moving. Now, this will be given as a lump sum to the person. I mean, they'll go there for the year then and work in.
And 80,000 of it goes to implement their idea, yeah. And the balance is for transportation, living, and we just had to make an arbitrary decision on that. But you know, yes, sir. Oh, sorry.
And I have three questions for Mr. Prime Minister. I'm Emma from China, and I'm working for Economic Weekly magazine in Beijing. And third question, the first one is,
Ni hao.
you've been involved in lots of activities since your resignation in 2007. And why did you choose agriculture?
Well, I've chosen really Africa, the Africa governance and the idea of helping African countries to make change, but obviously agriculture is a major priority for many African governments. And so the partnership with Howard and Howard's Foundation has allowed us to get into this area. And, you know, what I was trying to say to people today is there are some fantastic ideas and thinking out there. And, you know, we can help people bring those ideas to those countries and implement it. And that's, you know, that's the great benefit that we have.
Well, if I can just add to that, the power of agriculture is, you know, we see it in our country differently because we're 200 years later than when we started. But, you know, when you have 70% of your population living in a rural area, you know, there is no more powerful tool than to develop agriculture, because it also forces you to do what this country did, rural electrification, infrastructure of roads, co-ops came out of it, which were a powerful tool in developing our productivity. So seed businesses, I mean, Pioneer, Paul Schickler standing here, I mean, Pioneer goes way back to the beginning of, you know, what built America and makes us the production, you know, has helped us create and reach the production that we have today. So I think, you know, if you look at any, so I would say number one, rural development driven by agriculture is a key to success. And I would say that that's been proven all over the world. I mean, you don't find a country feeding itself that's success. You know, you have to be able to feed yourself to be successful, and you don't find a country that's not feeding itself that's very successful. I mean, if they are, in some ways, they have serious problems in other ways. So, you know, it's balance of trade even. I mean, it's all the things you can do. So I think that agriculture is an absolute key driver to any success in a country.
Actually, it seems like you pay more attention in Africa or Middle East than in China or in Asia. And what's the reason?
Well, Africa has been a passion of mine when I was prime minister and since leaving office. Doesn't mean to say we do work in other parts of the world as well. But for me, the reason I started the Africa Governance Initiative is because I think Africa is the one continent in the world that for many years was not lifting itself up in the way that it could. Now it's starting to do that, and that's a very exciting thing, and it's what I wanted to be part of.
I'm Alex from Brazil, and my English is not very good, so my colleague from Argentina helped me.
Okay. Hi. My name is Sofia. The question from Alexa is for Tony Blair. Yesterday, the Tanzanian agriculture minister of agriculture of Tanzania, she understood. He said that Europe is pressing agricultures in Tanzania not to adopt transgenic technology, and she wants to know if you are aware of this and if is it Europe doing something about it.
Actually, I'm not aware of it, so I probably shouldn't comment on it. But in any event, I'm sure the Tanzanians are very capable of taking their own decisions.
Hello?
Yes, Mr. Blair. I'm from Argentina. I'd like to know what is your opinion about trade, about free trade, and the role of free trade from developing countries, because there are a lot of countries that are worried about the role of the trade from their agricultural products.
Well, I think in general terms, the more you open up trade, the better for the global economy. I actually think for African countries, one of their first things is to reduce tariffs between the countries, by the way, because that's a major inhibition on them. But you know, I was part of the European Council when we opened up Europe to everything but arms from Africa under the everything but arms policy, and I continue to support free trade.
Hello. My name is Daniel. I work with The Guardian in Tanzania. Thank you very much. I think Mr. Howard and His Excellency Prime Minister Tony Blair know that Africa is a rich continent. And Howard, I was reading one of his photos. He has gone through Africa, the Maasai, and what. But Africa, China, and the Western countries are scrambling to get our resources. But still, there are some people who are dying or are starving of hunger. So I wanted to know, as far as you are dealing with African countries, where have we fared? And what should we do? And what advice have you given to our leaders back in Africa so that we get rid of repeated hunger and whatnot? Thank you.
Right. So I think the natural resources of Africa are a great opportunity for Africa, for African countries that are resource-rich. But it all depends how those resources are developed and how the money that is taken in as a result of the selling and developing of those resources, how that money is used. And this is where governance is essential. So you can look at examples in the world where countries have got natural resources and they've ended up poor at the end of it, but you can also look at examples of where they've ended up wealthy and developing. And so the advice I always give is the important thing is to develop those in a transparent way, in a way that is honest and decent, and to make sure that you use the resources of that to develop the infrastructure of the countries, which will be necessary for then African business to grow. And by the way, there are countries in Africa that are doing it in this way and are, as a result, making real strides forward for their people. So, you know, I don't think we should ever look at, I mean, you know, the fact that China has the need of those resources, that's a great opportunity. It just depends how we use that opportunity. And you know, for me, the important thing is that you want those resources to be developed by people who have got the right technical know-how, but do it in a way that is properly accountable and transparent. And then the question is, how do you use the wealth that comes out of that process to advance your own country? And, you know, as I say, it can be done, but the resources should always be looked at as an opportunity, not as a threat to the country.
My question is for Tony Blair. In terms of AGI, how are the 10 countries chosen? And I guess who is the conversation start with when you go to each country? Is it the Minister of Agriculture? Is it a percentage of agriculture? How are the 10 countries chosen?
Right. First of all, I should say that we're in 7 at the moment, but we've got my likelihood is we'll be in 10 by the end of the year. But and we don't simply work in agriculture, right? We work across the piece of governance. But what we find is agriculture is very often one of the priorities of the government. So what we say to the government is, look, you tell us what your priorities are, we'll help you deliver them. For the countries, it's really, they've got to want our help. We have no, I'm not in government anymore. I can't go and insist that, and there's no point in doing this. This only works on a basis of a willing partnership. But having started in some countries and I think people have seen the results, now we actually do have a queue of countries wanting to join the program, because what we do is we say to the leadership of those countries, we're here to help. We're not here to tell you what you think you should be doing, because we think you'll probably know what you should be doing. But we're here to help you deliver those programs. And whether it's in agriculture or infrastructure, one of the major things now, of course, is issues to do with power and electricity. Whatever it is, we're there to help deliver them. So what we find is those countries, at first I was more in the position of approaching the presidents when we first began it. Actually, we started with Sierra Leone and Rwanda. And in those cases, I had long-standing relationships, and we started there. But now we find people actually come to us.
Hi, I'm George Kalunga from Malawi. Basically, I have two questions. The other one will clarify what maybe she wanted to ask. But the first one, I would like to know from you, what is your opinion on the issue of African governments providing subsidies to farmers? In view probably of a country like Malawi, where at something like 60 or 70% of the funding for agriculture goes to subsidy, but still you find people are facing hunger year in, year out. The other question was...
Do you want to answer that?
Yeah. Okay. The other question was, one of the technologies that are being promoted in terms of agriculture is the use of GMO, GM crops. And it is the opinion of other experts or other observers in Africa that probably this technology, it hasn't really worked well elsewhere, where you have countries like maybe in Europe which don't actually accept these products, and then they are trying like to be pushed on Africa. In Malawi, for example, there are people who fear of maybe where would we sell our crops if our main market is in Europe, and then there they can't accept GM crops. Maybe I would like just to give you, to get your opinion on that.
I'm glad you didn't ask anything controversial. all right, I'll try to take those one at a time. Tony graciously handed them off to me.
I'll follow your lead.
Okay. So on the subsidy issue, I think I may not be in the same camp as everybody. I don't know. But there's not a country in the world that I'm aware of that has a powerful agricultural system that did not use subsidies to get there. So I don't think it's whether you have subsidies. I think it's what are they and how are they used, and are they equitable in terms of the distribution? And the argument in this country typically is two things. One is, what are the consequences of them? What behavior do they drive? And I think we're in the midst of debating vigorously how we go from where we've been to where we need to be on that issue. And the other is it equitable? And so I absolutely believe that I look at agriculture as important as a Department of Defense. If you can't feed your country, then you're vulnerable to lots of things. And so I would put it on par with as part of the element that you have to have in order to have success and to defend your country and to make your people successful. So I don't think agriculture oftentimes gets the respect that it should have. So to build that system, I absolutely think that subsidies in most cases are going to be part of that. I think it gets into the details. It's not so much the concept as it is how they're applied and what they are and how they're used. So the second part of the question on the GMOs, you know, how should they be used? Okay, well, I would answer that. There's a little bit of a different answer for Malawi than there is for here, maybe, but I think there's some overlap. I think it's really important that subsidies are used to make sure that farmers have a fallback position. So we used to have a program in this country that was basically the FSA, it was ASCSN, but it's a government organization, would set the floor for a price. And so you knew that, you know, if your cost of productivity, your cost of production was a certain price, that the government would pretty much ensure that you had that covered. So I think that's an important thing, particularly in a country that's trying to develop agriculture. You keep farmers in business, and you deal with the disasters that come along, which we've always done here. And so part of that is disaster relief. So it's drought, it's floods. And the other thing is that I think where we have failed in this country, and Brazil is a shining star, and I think that every African country could do this and should do it, is build a system based on conservation agriculture. The greatest asset a farmer has is soil, and soil's not sexy, and soil isn't dirt. Gets treated like dirt. And so we have to change how people feel about that. You can talk about all the yield in the world, and yield's important. Don't get me wrong. Yield's pretty important. You can talk about all the yield in the world, but you're not growing it unless you have the land that can produce it. So I think you have to have subsidies that create behavior that take care of your natural resources, protect your water resources, protect your soils. And we've not done as good a job in this country on that as we could do. And that can be done in Africa, and it needs to be done in Africa. Africa has some of the most weathered soils of any continent in the world, and it has some of the highest percentage of degraded soils in the world. And it's easy to understand why all that happened. But now we gotta say, how do we fix that, and how do we prevent it from deteriorating further? You gotta talk about your productivity from the bottom up, from starting with what your soil will produce. And so that's a big challenge in Africa. Am I answering the question? I mean, that's okay. On GMOs, you know, that's always a really touchy subject. I will tell you that it's more complicated than just simply saying, you know, are they good or are they bad? The primary battle on GMOs was fought in this country, and we have more regulatory agencies in this country than anywhere in the world that are based more on science than politics or anything else. So I think you have to take that into account when you make an assessment of whether you want to accept GMOs or not. The Prime Minister is absolutely correct. This is a decision for the country. Okay, this is not a decision for any other company or any NGO or any other organization. This is a decision for the country of what they want and how they want it. So, you know, that's an important point to make. I will tell you one reason why it's not so black and white in terms of how GMOs work is that, you know, there's a lot of accusations about the impact of GMOs. You won't know the answer to a lot of that for 20 years. So, you know, it's not as easy to simply say they're all bad. On the other hand, there are precautions that absolutely need to be taken in their use because of the impact that they can have on, you know, I mean, most of it has to do with pollination or movement of pollen in terms of what impact can they have. There's a lot of studies on it. There's a lot of disagreement on it. I'm not an expert on it. What I do know is that if you want to talk about pure productivity, it has increased my productivity on my farms. There's no question about it. There's people who disagree with that, but I've been farming for 35 years, and I can tell you what my experience is. You can disagree with my experience, but I can show you what my experience is, and that it's that simple. One reason that I think gets lost in all of this is that it isn't only about the GMO aspect of it. A lot of companies have made big investments in improving hybrids as a result of that driving factor. So those hybrids are much more vigorous today than they ever were, and that's part of where the productivity comes from. So I don't think this is a simple answer to give, because there are a lot of sides to the debate, and I can answer it from my own personal experience and say that it has increased productivity. But I will also say that, like anything that you do in the natural world, because we have spent a lot of time in conservation efforts, anything you do in the natural world, you better understand what the consequences are, because you cannot turn the clock back sometimes. So I think science, this debate needs to be driven by science, and a lot of it's not.
And I agree with all of that.
And I think we need to wrap up right now, but thank you all very much for coming.
Can you let her ask her a question?
Yes, go ahead.
I can't hear you, so. Yes.
Oh, yes.
Well, we've been piloting in lots of places with different conservation agriculture. I think we're the only people who have two oxen in Arizona on our farm, research farm down there, and we have oxen in South Africa. Because to me, it's easy to talk about what we can do in this country in conservation agriculture. We know how to do it. We know how to make the equipment. We just don't do it all the time. And can it get better? Of course it can get better. What we're interested in is how do you give small farmers in Africa an opportunity to make a choice on different farming methods so that they have the opportunity to understand that they can also take care of their land and increase productivity at the same time, that they're not mutually exclusive by any means. So, you know, Pioneer has worked with us a lot on how do we get the right cover crop. It, even on our farm in South Africa, it's incredibly difficult to get the kind of cover crops we want to do the experiments that we want to do. So we felt we need to do it in African climate. We need to do it with African partners. We need to do it in a way that small farmers do it, not the way we do it. So what we're hoping to develop in the long term is a system that can be adopted by farmers that don't have mechanization, but if they want to go to mechanization, they already have learned, they have the knowledge of the system, they have equipment that can work on an oxen-based system that can transfer to easily to a 50-55 horsepower type of mechanized tractor, so that they don't have to relearn or restart or make another big investment. It's a challenging thing to do, but what I do know is where it's been done, and Ghana is a great example because they've had huge success with this in Ghana. And there's a guy we work with there, Ghanaian Kofi Boa, who is a phenomenal individual. We all love him at our foundation, and he is committed to spread this word across Ghana, and he has had huge success. If you can have success in Ghana, you have four major different growing agri-zones in Ghana, and he's worked in all of them. If you can have success there, you can have success anywhere. There are people who rail against it because they have other agendas, and they have other reasons that they want to see you do things a certain way. What I believe in is giving farmers enough opportunity to have enough knowledge that they make their choices, that other people don't make choices for them. I feel sometimes in this country that some of my choices are less than what they were before, but then I also have other opportunities that I didn't have 10 years ago. It's a balancing act, and nothing's right or wrong all the time. It isn't that simple. But conservation agriculture has – Brazil has been unbelievable in what they've done in conservation agriculture, primarily no-till. which is not the only piece of it, but they've done an unbelievable job in it, and they've done it also with their smallholder farmers, and they've combined programs to make sure those smallholder farmers are successful. So when you ask about subsidies, it isn't as simple as say, let's give subsidies for fertilizer or let's do crop insurance. You know, Brazil's been really innovative how they've done it. What they've done is they've incorporated their small farmers into vegetable production and milk production into a school feeding program. And, you know, school feeding is a whole other thing. You can't stop me if you get me started on about that. But anyway, you know, so there are ways to do this. There are success stories. There are governments who have done it right. And they don't always get it right the first time. But the biggest bottom line thing that I believe in agriculture is give farmers knowledge and give them choices and let them be independent in how they want to do it.